We are now recording, so we can do this.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercer, and we are back with the first international, or is it interstellar, edition of Crave, the podcast about films and music and television and pretty much anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe over the last week or three, perhaps.
Several, actually. We've been very remiss, haven't we? Very slack.
We've been busy.
I mean, really, Crave should be our priority, but, you know,
life gets in the way sometimes.
Life does get in the way.
Anyway, this time we are going to go... Shall I use this hackneyed phrase?
I think you have to, don't you?
I have to. We will go where many have boldly gone before, and we should look at the latest in a very long line of series, both filmic and televisual, in the Star Trek universe.
Absolutely. Now, it might not be quite as topical as Star Trek, but it's about time we had a few words about Westworld.
I think so. Steve, you've revisited your teenage years, which is not... that long ago, not as long ago as mine.
It's relative, really, isn't it?
At Adam Ant's concert in Auckland. And I think you enjoyed the show, but I looking forward to hearing your thoughts on a few restrictions that you had to work around while you were out there doing some photography.
Absolutely.
Or attempting to.
Well, I wasn't in it, as it turns out, but, you know, stay tuned. Yep. Now, Simon, yes. You'd be reading more about the girl with... what's she doing this time?
Now, we've left the dragon tattoo behind.
Okay, right.
In terms of the titles. It's yet another one. I've got a few things to say about it. I'll leave you in suspense, Steve, until later on that one. But it's I've got some positive things to say about the girl.
Okay, the girl.
We're talking about the Swedish... What's it called? Scandi Noir? Scandi Crime? What's the...
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Scandi Noir is what we're going with this one, I think, yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's a book. This is a radical departure for Crave. It's a book.
Yes.
Anyway, now let's start off-world, shall we, Steve?
I think we should.
So we've both been catching the latest in Star Trek, and Steve, I just did a quick bit of looking around at what's happened before we've got to this latest Star Trek series, which is called Star Trek Discovery. There have been 13 Star Trek movies so far.
13. Wow.
And this would be, Star Trek Discovery would be the sixth TV series. You put that all together, I think that's
right. Yeah, that
sounds
about right. Yeah.
There's an animated series in there as well, which I'm not going to count.
No.
But, I mean, that's a lot of Star Trek. But most of the time I've enjoyed it. I think you've seen a lot of it. I've seen quite a lot of it. I've seen the most recent films. I've enjoyed this Star Trek Discovery so far. It's interesting. First of all, it's not on your mainstream TV. It's... Free to air. It's on Netflix. It's set, just to put a bit of context, it's set a few years before the James Kirk, Mr. Spock series. And the main character is not the captain, which is interesting and a little different. The character is Michael Burnham, but that's a woman, and she's played by the actress Sonequa Martin-Green. I think it's Sonequa. Have you heard any different pronunciation?
No, it sounds about right to me.
Sneak for Martin Green. So she, and this, they've twisted a few things around in the usual Star Trek sort of setup here, haven't they, Steve? Michael Burnham, she plays a very talented, smart, resourceful Starfleet captain, not a captain yet, she wants to be a captain,
yes.
who is human but was raised in the Vulcan culture. So that right there is a point of difference from previous type of iterations of Star Trek. And what we've seen so far is the series takes you to a time when the Federation is basically at war with the Klingons, and our lead character has got herself on the wrong side of the Federation, as we've seen in the first two or three episodes, is basically officially seen as a bad guy, a mutineer, and is trying to recoup her reputation and her pride and her self-esteem by joining the Discovery. In fact, she's requisitioned to join the Discovery, isn't she, Steve?
Well, that's what happens. Kind of press ganged into it, really, isn't
she?
Yeah.
So it's a different sort of setup.
It is.
I've seen four episodes. I think you've seen at least three so far, Steve.
I've seen three so far. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just interested in what you have to think, what you say about this, because I know you've got a lot of Star Trek episodes in the bank that you've seen before. What's your initial impression of all this?
Well, I would specify from the outset, I am not a hardcore Trekkie. That's
okay.
We're not. I'm not claiming those credentials, but I have seen over the years a few of the series, yeah. And I've seen obviously there's been a progression. You know, the first one obviously was groundbreaking in the way it did science fiction. Then there was The Next Generation, which was very bright and very primary colours and very optimistic and. Very nearly every single character in The Next Generation could be mapped onto a character in the original series. You could see exactly what a continuity it was, what a continuation. Then came Deep Space Nine.
That's one I haven't seen, but you quite like that one, don't you?
I'm of the opinion that's the best series they've done so far, okay. Although we're reserving judgment until we see more of Discovery, obviously. Yeah. But Deep Space Nine was the first time when we didn't have every single... Starship crew member wearing a white hat.
Right.
Suddenly there was conflict and there was light and shade and there were characters who were morally ambiguous and there were characters who weren't defined simply as being Federation officers who were going to come in peace and not shoot to kill and all the rest.
Yes.
So then we had very conflicted characters who had their own internal motivations. We also incidentally had the worst actor ever to appear in the Star Trek series.
Oh, who was that? Who was that?
I actually can't even remember the character, the actor's name. The character was Benjamin Sisko, the captain in that series.
Oh, okay.
Ah. One of the most wooden actors I have ever had the misfortune to see on Star Trek.
Okay.
So that's
why it was good in spite of that.
In spite of that, that's how good the rest of the series was. I mean, even one of the actors. Now, at the time, he was Alexander Siddig. He was going by at the time. He's since shown up in Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay.
So that gives you an idea of the acting caliber.
Yeah.
So that's the background that I'm coming from. I'm a fan of, I skipped a couple of the series. I never really engaged with Voyager.
No, neither did I. Enterprise that much, I have to say.
No, they tried really hard, didn't they?
Yeah. I have, just quickly before we get back to Discovery, I've quite enjoyed the three movies, that the most recent ones that have are retelling the early years of Kirk and Spock, especially the first one. I thought the first one was a really good hoot, and they captured the spirit of it really well.
Oh, these are the Chris Pine films, aren't they?
The Chris Pine films, yeah. So we're dancing all over the universe, getting off away from Discovery, but it's all relevant to a new series, which is trying to, I guess, it's interesting. It's sitting alongside the film series. They're basically going to run at the same time.
Yeah.
Overall, I've quite enjoyed Discovery. I like Sonequa Martin-Green as Michael Burnham. I think she's I find her quite a charismatic character, actress, even though the character she's playing, because of her Vulcan upbringing, is quite a cold, character, isn't she? She's not a expressive, emotive person, obviously.
And yet they do allow her human roots to shine through quite well, don't they?
Yeah, and she's conflicted, which... makes for a good drama. I'm not so impressed with the other characters so far.
There are other characters?
Yeah, well, there you are. Yeah, I find the... none so memorable. I think the one interesting thing is the new captain on the Discovery is a guy called Captain Lorca, played by... I think he's a British actor, isn't he? Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs, yes.
And he's also not such a clean, squeaky clean character either.
No, so there's a backstory there that we're waiting to find out about, clearly.
Yeah, so I think that's... potentially interesting. I think we might, you and I might, I'm looking forward to what you have to say about the appearance in the first two episodes of the actress Michelle Yeoh, who plays the captain we first meet. I've quite liked her for a long time, and I quite liked her in Discovery, but I'm not sure if you did.
Well, I mean, she's a fantastic actress. She's got pedigree, she's got form, she's got bags of talent.
Yeah.
And again, I just had this feeling that she'd been directed into playing the character in a very wooden and terribly stilted manner. That's how I came across.
That's how
it felt to me. I just couldn't quite warm to.
Okay. I took it that she was channeling the need for a captain to sort of be above the fray a little bit and be emotionally detached from the crew and make these wise and logical decisions. But maybe I might have overread that. I still enjoyed her performance, but it was interesting. I think you had the sense that although she was the captain, she wasn't the central character.
Yes.
And that's, as we now know, she I think we can say this because we're into the fourth episode now. She doesn't last long in the series.
Things that happen in episode two can't really be seen as massive spoilers, I don't think.
No, no. So she cops it. She goes to the great Star Trek cemetery. I was going to say in the sky, but they're all in the sky.
You're trying to make that one work. It's not quite happening, is it, to be fair?
No. But I certainly think the fact that the Captain Lorca, the new captain, and Michael Burnham, played by Snooker Martin Green, are both, as you said, what did you say before, Steve, Lily White or White
Hat? Well, they were all wearing the white hats, weren't they?
Yeah, well, these guys aren't. I think that makes it more interesting. And it's a very well-produced series. It looks good. And it's a little different in that it's an out-and-out conflict with the Klingons, not dancing around the diplomacy very much here. It's basically war, which is a bit different than the usual Star Trek setting, perhaps. So I think it's got enough there to keep me watching for a bit longer.
I've seen three, you've seen four episodes so far. It seems to have enough heft, enough depth, that I'd like to carry on finding out where it's going.
Yeah.
We've got hints that there's something going on Discovery that are questionable.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, so you're quite right, yeah.
And this is not the Enterprise. This is not quite as... how shall we say, as absolutely transparent and as utterly innocent as maybe the Federation are meant to be.
Yes, I think that's well summed up. So if you have been a Star Trek fan, even a moderate one, I think there's enough here enough different from previous versions to warrant a look. And it's on Netflix right now. They're up to the fourth episode, but of course, being Netflix, you can watch it anytime you want.
And one question that has to be asked is, could you go into this cold? Does it stand alone?
Well, that's a good question. I guess Star Trek seems to have been in our cultural universe for so long, it's hard to imagine people who have got no knowledge of it. But if you had no knowledge of it, probably you could. It's just another sci-fi adventure, I suppose.
Yeah, you don't need to be a hardcore Trekkie here, do you?
No, I don't think you do. I don't think you do. Which is a good thing.
Well, not everybody is.
No.
But if you are, that's okay.
Yes.
We don't judge here on Crave.
No, we don't. Anyway, that's Star Trek Discovery. Okay. Speaking of matters science fiction, Steve.
Yep. Effortlessly done.
I know. And also something that's also on Netflix, as it happens.
Is it? Something called... Are you sure about that?
Actually, no, it's not.
No, it's HBO, isn't it?
It is HBO. I take
that. Right. That's research for you.
You know where I watched? We're talking about Westworld.
We are.
Which the first season screened last year, and I think the second season is about to commence.
Yes.
I actually saw this. I've been away overseas, Steve, and I had two long haul flights. And I watched the entire season.
Wow, that's commitment.
That's commitment.
That really is.
Spread over the two flights, so it's still fresh in my mind. I hadn't seen the original film way back in the late 60s with Yul Brynner. Had you seen that?
Yeah, 73 it was.
73. Gosh. All right. Did that leave much of an impression on you? I remember the poster.
Yeah.
That's the thing I remember of it.
I have seen it. I'm vaguely aware of it. I saw it in my youth,
okay,
a long time ago. But it was one of those films that everyone knows about with and everyone talks about with affection, but nobody ever really wants to go back and watch again. There's got to be a reason for that.
There's got to be a reason. Well, I mean, I guess we're mentioning this today, Steve, given that we're expecting a new season quite soon. But I just thought it's interesting that with all the... whether it's HBO or whatever it is, a lot of these series you can watch at your discretion, right?
I mean, yeah.
And that's the whole point of it. So I don't feel, you know, I think it's interesting to talk about this one, which I thought was very slickly put together, very science fiction-y, all about the artificial humans being created. for the pleasure of ordinary humans and these sort of huge adventures. It's almost like a Jurassic Park without dinosaurs.
Well, that's a great analogy. I like that.
So it just came to me just then. And
then that's why you get paid the big Crave books, mate. Yeah, seriously.
I don't expect another one. I quite enjoyed it. I particularly enjoyed the performance, as one usually does, of Anthony Hopkins, who plays the, I suppose, the mastermind behind these artificial humans. I find him still a very a wonderful actor to watch and do his perform his craft.
No scenery left unchewed, though, to be fair.
Yeah, but he doesn't. That's true, but he doesn't do it in a over the top way. And what I mean in a histrionic way, it's all understated, but with long pauses, and you know, it's all in the face and the intonation, and it's
okay. So it's scenery nibbling.
But it's scenery stealing as well, I think.
Well, scene stealing, yeah. I mean, let's face it, this is Anthony Hopkins we're dealing with here, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I was a captive audience on a plane. No, I didn't have anywhere else to go.
Right.
So I watched it all. But I found it sustained my interest pretty well. I thought it got a little convoluted towards the end.
Oh, a little.
Yeah, a little. And it's clearly being set up. You could see that they've dangled the possibility of another type of, not Westworld, but maybe a world set somewhere else for another season. Do you think you'll go back for this next one coming up, the next season?
Well, yeah. I mean, partly. I feel like I invested a lot in it. There were 10 episodes, weren't there?
Yeah.
And we were put through the ringer.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on. And I felt there was an awful lot that was never, ever tied up. There were a lot of questions. I mean, yeah. I'm reluctant to say too much about the structure of the narrative because we could be getting into spoiler territory if we say too much. But it does take until the very, very end for you to figure out exactly how the narrative is constructed.
Excuse me. Yeah. Most of the time, Steve, that kept me interested. I thought there was an element of mystery to how they were telling the story, and I wasn't quite sure where it was going, and so that hooked me mostly. Although, as I say, towards especially in the last few episodes, as they were trying to tie a few loose ends up, I started to get a little frustrated. But the acting is good, and the mixture of sort of action and that sort of and genuine drama and mystery and a sense of a thriller. So all in all, I think it's a pretty slick production. And I certainly, I don't have any other long haul flights coming up, but for the next season. But I would probably, you know, certainly be interested to see the first two or three to see where this new season takes us.
Well, what I want to know is, are they going to bring back Thandi Newton?
Wow.
Without her, I mean, she made the show for me. She really did. I would be disappointed to see a Westworld that doesn't have her in it.
Yeah. Actually, it's just she was very, very good. And this was as you said, HBO, so it had quite a bit of nudity and violence, quite graphic violence, and quite male and female nudity. Do you think that was done for a shock effect, or was it just did it seem a realistic part of the story they were telling?
Well, it's HBO, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you do wonder sometimes, you know, there's obviously sort of somebody's got a sign on the wall somewhere in the production office at HBO that says, "We show boobs because we can." and you definitely get the feeling that they push the limits and they transgress whenever possible because they know that within the American context, what they do is profoundly transgressive.
Yeah,
you know, famously on American TV, you can show graphic violence, but you can't have people swearing about it.
No.
Game of Thrones is the high watermark of this, obviously.
Yes.
So yeah, I do suspect that HBO have got a little thing going on where we'll do what we can because we know that we can.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was interesting that Thandi Newton is a very well established actress, and she's been around for a while, and she's and I just thought it was interesting that she was quite happy to be naked so much. That was what the character called for, but it was just an interesting choice for the actor. And good on her, she did it very well. I mean, what I mean is, you know, it was all in character and it all fitted with the others and what was happening in the story.
It did, and it was also done very, very clinically as well. There's being nude and there's being naked.
Yes.
And there is a profound difference there. And yeah, I mean, it was done the storyline called for it. I think it's the usual thing there. But that's what HBO do. They push boundaries that broadcast TV in America simply can't push. That's kind of their shtick. So if they can get away with it, they're going to.
Yeah.
So they'll swear and they'll have sex and they'll do all the naughty bits and all the things that their terrestrial broadcast counterparts simply can't pull off. That's what HBO do. They can also do big, sumptuous, extraordinarily well-produced series that don't conform to the 23-episode series model of the American studios.
Right.
They can do what, well, we think this needs 10 episodes, and there'll be an hour each. No commercial breaks. That's what we're making, and that's how we're going to make it. HBO have been able to make stuff on their own terms ever since The Sopranos.
Mm.
Netflix have carried the torch on that one quite brilliantly. But they have changed the way that TV gets made. I think Westworld is a great example of that.
Hey, now, Steve, Westworld deals with the well-explored topic in science fiction of artificial life. And the whole issue of whether humans or artificially created humans can have a true consciousness or not.
It raises questions like, for example, would they, dream of electric sheep, for example?
what a segue that is. Yes, would they?
I know.
That, of course, is what's been explored in the cinema just the last few days with the release, the long-awaited release of the second Blade Runner film. This is Blade Runner 2049.
Which makes it sound like it's a really, really long series, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Episode 2048 was crap, but 2049 is brilliant.
Yeah, very good. I know you haven't seen it, so I won't dwell on this too long, but I just want to say I was interested to see it. I thought the first one was left an impact on me. I do like sci-fi. It was such a visual treat, that first one, and the soundtrack was amazing. And I remember it for an extremely memorable climactic scene between the Blade Runner Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, and the Rutger Hauer, that's the German actor
yes.
who played the replicant, dying in the rain on the rooftop with a soliloquy about what it is to be human or not. And that was a great scene, and I remember the film for that as much as anything else. So I just want to say I think they've done an excellent job. It looks fantastic. The soundtrack is also really jarring and memorable again. As you can tell by the posters, they brought back Harrison Ford as the character, Deckard, the same guy.
Hardly a spoiler at this stage, is it?
No. They have tied the story of the first one to this story. So it's a definite continuation of not just Deckard, but other characters he was involved with in the first film.
Right.
Ryan Gosling is the new Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the screen for the whole film. Ford doesn't appear till relatively late in the piece.
Yeah.
It's a mystery. It kept me guessing quite well. A few good signposts, but then a couple of twists. And I have to say this. I mean, I guess you think of Harrison Ford as a great action type character, don't you? Indiana Jones Star Wars and whatever. But I thought he was really, really good. I thought he was really good in the time he was on screen playing the older version of the man we saw 30, 40 years ago. I think he kind of stole it. He did. For me, he took the film. So I think it's really worth going. It's a visual treat. It's long. It's
yes.
about 3 hours 40. So it's not...
That's a lot of Blade Runner.
It's a lot of Blade Running. But if you have any, if you remember the first one, if you like sight, in fact, you almost have to see the first one.
Right.
I don't think you're going to get as much out of it if you haven't seen the first one.
Right.
But it's, and the director, Denis Villeneuve.
Yes.
I saw an article just in the British media calling on him to direct the next James Bond as a result of this Blade Runner film.
Yes, that's been touted, hasn't it? Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I know you're probably not quite as hot as I am on sci-fi, but I think you'd probably...
I like good sci-fi.
Yeah, well, I think you'd like it. I don't, you know.
So are we counting this as good sci-fi?
I am, yes.
Well, there you go, then. In that case, you've sold me. But I'm gonna have to carve out time to watch the original Blade Runner in that case.
I think you should.
It sounds like that's a definite prerequisite.
Yeah, absolutely. Do that first.
You're on.
Okay. Now, Steve, let's change tack. Let's get into some music. I want to hear about a bloke. I remember this guy when he was around, and he had such a catchy name, Adam Ant.
Yeah, we're going back a few years here, aren't we?
Is it decades since he was doing his thing? But you've been to the Spark Arena to see him perform.
Oh, not Spark Arena, mate. No. Oh, no, he's not that big. He half filled the power station.
Ah. Oh.
It was not full at all, seriously. Because, I mean, seriously, he's a legacy act these days.
Yeah.
And it was people of my age, you know, as in, not the youngest people in the world anymore, to be fair, who were there for the music of their childhood.
Yeah.
And that's what he delivered. That's what he stood and delivered. I know, I'm proud of that one. But, I mean, look. On the way, I was talking to Debbie, our intrepid guest reviewer, and we were saying, look, we'll leave early if it's no good, because he's 62 years old and he's going to be going through the motions, or if it's any good, you know, we'll stay till the end. And she said, yeah, and if it's no good, then we're just not going to go and see old man concerts anymore. I thought that's fair enough. We'll give it a go and see if he's actually any good. And yeah, I mean, he's, like I say, he's 62, but oh dear Lord. He's still got energy. I think what the smartest thing he did was, his backing band were all too young to have been around when his records were being released first time round.
Right.
They were all in their 20s, I think. That's how you do it. You surround yourself with young people. That's how you stay young. And he put on a fantastic show. The thing that people are doing these days is doing complete runs through classic albums.
Yes.
And so this was the Kings of the Wild Frontier tour, and so he played for the first 45 minutes of the show the entire Kings of the Wild Frontier album that came out apparently 40 years ago
in the order it was released, the track order,
track by track. That's the thing these days, is doing, you know, tributes to your own albums. So he did that, and it went down a storm. The funny thing is, though, you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean, haven't you?
Yes.
You're familiar with the character of Captain Jack Sparrow?
Jack Sparrow, yes.
This is where it came from. Forget Keith Richards. It was like seeing Jack Sparrow on stage. It was like seeing Jack Sparrow on crystal meth on stage. It was the funniest thing. He was like, he'd prance around in time with the music and then suddenly stop and throw a weird shape, but not quite in time with the music. It was a very, very jarring effect. And he's got the most piercing eyes. And I swear, there were about 300 of us there. Every single person in the audience must have felt he was looking at them directly. Very affecting. But great fun. I mean, the man's barking mad. Let's just get that out of the way.
Okay. Did he do much chatting to the audience to reinforce that?
Well, no. I mean, the first 45 minutes, he didn't say a single word.
Okay.
And then at the end of the first out of playing the album, he said, look, sorry about that. We had to get the album played. Now I can talk to you. okay. So the whole thing was very, very peculiar.
Yeah.
But it was fun. And I really enjoyed it. But if anyone listening to this remembers anything about Adam Ant, what they will remember, or Adam and the Ants as he was back then, they'll remember his big shtick was two drummers.
Okay.
And the big Burundi beats, the big pounding, hammering glam rock, so taking the old glitter beat from glam rock and then building on that, having the two drummers pounding away. So there's two drummers on stage, and it worked astonishingly well. There was, in particular, a young woman who goes by the name of Yola, who never heard of her before, can't find out too much about her online, but I have never seen anyone play drums like that girl. I could have watched her all night. She was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
If you're going to get the chance, I mean, I doubt he'll come back to New Zealand at this stage, to be fair. Apparently, it's the first time they've ever been here.
Yeah.
I have a sneaking suspicion it might be the last. Mm-hmm. But I'm awfully glad I went.
Yeah. Well, that young drummer will appear somewhere else for sure.
I will be looking out for her. She was fantastic.
As much as you enjoyed the music,
yeah,
I do understand, however, you have some reservations about other aspects of the organisation of the night.
Well, as you know, Simon, we one thing that we do like to do here at the cravepodcast.com website is do photography from the concerts that we attend. And most of the time, publicists and promoters and management for bands are very accommodating because they understand that we provide publicity for concerts. If I go and shoot a show and I get really good photos, and usually we're given great access. We're down in the photo pit in front of the audience. We get great access. We get, as a result, we can get fantastic photos of bands. And it gives good publicity to a band. You can see what the show looks like. You can see, you know, that these are people who put on good performances and all the rest. Excellent. And usually we're asked to sign a release that says that we will only use our photos for the outlet that has been authorised to shoot. And that seems entirely reasonable. And we also say that we're not going to shoot to use those images for our own commercial gain. So, for example, if I use the photos I took at Midnight Oil last month to make T-shirts and sell them, that will be a violation. I think that's entirely fair and reasonable. Last week, I was supposed to go and shoot Peter Hook, late of New Order. We recorded Blue Monday. New Order and Joy Division.
Okay.
And when I got to the venue, I was given a photo release to sign that says that I would send all of my photos to his management, who could then use my photos in any way they saw fit with no compensation to me whatsoever.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, there were five of us who were going to shoot the concert that night. None of us were willing to sign the photo release. We all handed our photo passes back, and we went next door and had a beer instead.
Well, absolutely right to do so.
Yeah,
that's like a tantamount to saying we're just going to hijack your work and leave you with nothing.
Well, Adam Ant had something very, very similar.
Okay.
We were expected to submit all our photos ahead of publication for his management's approval, and then they could help themselves to one photo that they like the look of and use again as they see fit. And apparently he's been using photographs submitted this way for things like T-shirts that he's been selling with no credit given, certainly no payment given. He's getting free photography.
Yeah.
Now, I did try contacting Peter Hook's management, and they blew me off saying, well, you know, we're doing you a favour letting you in. And I'm thinking, well, we're doing you a favour publicising your artist, mate.
Yeah.
So there's an impasse there. But the bottom line is, one thing that Crave is not going to do is shoot concerts where we're expected to give our work away for free.
No.
Not many bands do this. I had a look recently. I think we've got 50-odd photo galleries from various concerts at the Crave website right now. Two so far have had these restrictive photo releases. At Crave, we've decided that we're not going to shoot concerts that have these rights grab photo releases in future. Disappointing, really, because Adam Ant would have been a fantastic show to shoot.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah,
but we have principles, don't we, Simon?
We do, and we're sticking by them.
Good man.
Long may that continue.
Absolutely.
Hey, yeah, no, that's good. That's good. I'm glad you did that. And we shouldn't allow any photographer shouldn't allow themselves to be walked over in such a way.
Absolutely. Now moving onwards. Let's have a look. Where are we up to? Books next. Books. And Simon, she's had a dragon tattoo.
She has.
She played with fire.
Yes, she did.
She kicked hornets' nests, which does seem very ill-advised.
Yes.
What's she been up to now?
Yes, but and after the hornet's nest, she was in the spider's web, and now.
But is that canonical?
Yeah. And now she takes an eye for an eye.
Oh dear.
So I've just read the fifth. It's only just been released in the last few weeks. The fifth in the what's called the Millennium series, Steve. This is the series that was started by the Swedish author Stieg Larsson.
Yes.
And he did the first three and famously died before the book could be published. He was a journalist and he created this sort of crusading journalist character one suspects was based on himself.
Okay.
called Mikhail Blomqvist. But he more famously created an incredible female character called Lisbeth Salander.
Right.
Who is a pint-sized, punk-looking, computer-hacking genius martial arts expert, social outcast,
okay,
and misfit, but an incredible heroine. And she drove, you know, the first three novels and the and what's happened after the publication of those three with the obviously with the agreement of the original author's family, another Swedish author called David Lagercrantz,
okay,
has taken up the cudgels, and he's now written two further novels in the series.
Excellent.
And they are both, I think, very good and actually better written as a piece of writing, I think, than the original author. No disrespect to the man, but I just think Lagercrantz is a better writer. He writes a tighter story. It's that whole less is more thing. And it's it just reads better. So this one, I think that I won't dwell on this, Steve. I don't think you've read this, but it's a great example of a story, any story, where this happens to be a novel, where you've got a fantastically memorable central character, but you don't hear much or read much of her in the course of the novel.
Okay, that sounds bizarre.
She's there, but she's not on every page by any means. There's big parts of the novel where you're not with her.
Okay.
And I guess the idea is it's just wants to have you, the author wants to have you clamoring for more, and he succeeds.
Well, I'm thinking this could possibly be why the Swedish title of the book is Mannen som sökte sin skugga, which apparently, as I'm sure you know, translates to the man who hunted his shadow.
Oh.
Not the girl who.
Now, okay.
It's been translated to English, apparently, as the girl who takes an eye for an eye. But the original Lagercrantz title was The Man Who.
Okay. Well, the reason for that, the story deals with twins.
Ah.
And Elizabeth Salander, we already know in the earlier in the series, has an evil twin called Camilla.
Ooh.
Yes. But in this story, there's another set of twins who are very much involved in the plot. And so I won't summarize the whole thing, Steve. It will take too long. But I just want to say it's well written. It's apparently there could be many more to come, and I think they're well worth it. It's been translated to TV and films, some of the original stories, and it could happen again. So David Lagercrantz, I'll get that right, David Lagercrantz, The Girl Who Takes an Eye for an Eye, the fifth installment of Lisbeth Salander. It's not a long book. It's well-paced. She's a kick-ass superhero. She's almost a superhero, actually. And she seems to be indestructible. And, if you're into that type of genre, especially that Scandi crime, boy, you're going to enjoy this one.
Now, you've been trying to get me to read these for years. One of these days, I'm going to listen to you.
Well, I actually found the first three that the original author wrote a very interesting story, but he put too much into them. He overwrote them, and he just wanted to put the kitchen sink in there. These are better for being not so crammed with every little detail that you need to know about how the main character has a cup of coffee and a fish sandwich every other hour or whatever it might be.
But the fact is, you read all three of them, so they had something going for them, didn't they?
Yeah. I did. Mainly because of of course, you know, I'm a journalist, and of course, how many novels have a crusading journalist as their lead one of the lead characters? I mean,
it was
wish fulfillment on my part, of course.
Right, of course.
Yes. Anyway, I would recommend it, if there is another one, I'll be reading that too.
Excellent. Well, that's a recommendation and a half right there, isn't it?
It is. Okay. So now you, on the other hand, have your own musical favourite, and this is a chap, Steve. You've mentioned him once or twice before.
Yes.
But with good reason. Skyscraper Stan. Tell me more.
Well, this is Skyscraper Stan. Stan Woodhouse to his closest mates.
Yes.
He's a long-time Crave favourite, isn't he? And we've talked about him in the past on the podcast. And he's coming back to New Zealand. He's a Kiwi, as I've mentioned before, who is now based in Australia, playing some very, very, very engaging American folk tinged folk rock kind of music. We covered him last year when he played with his band the Commission Flats, but this year he's coming back and doing a solo tour in November. Now dates are going to be on our website, of course, cravepodcast.com, but I got a chance to have a quick chat with Stan just recently. And he's talking about his tour, his music, and life in general. He's an interesting chap, is Stan. So here's what he had to say.
Just kicking it in Castlemaine.
In Castlemaine, that would be somewhere Australian, wouldn't it?
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I moved out here like 4 months ago, 5 months ago.
Okay, how's it treating you?
It's great. Living out in the country, got chickens.
Oh, just living the Australian dream, aren't you?
Yep. Raising chickens, writing songs. It's a dream come true.
Sounds good. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us this afternoon.
No worries.
So tell us a few things about what's going on in your life at the moment. So you're in Australia, and I have to ask, because I had a very quick look on your website for a bit of research, because I'm professional like that.
I would have found that the website's practically empty.
Well, the first thing that struck me is you've got a great big message across the top that says, no upcoming tour dates.
Right, okay, well, I need to update that.
it occurs to me that you seem to have written New Zealand out of your biography.
Have I?
Well, there's no reference in the bio to you being a Kiwi. There's a reference to your hometown and then relocating to Melbourne. And so I have to ask you, what's wrong with New Zealand these days?
Nothing. It must have... I'll tell you what it would be. I would have copied and pasted the bio from an Australian grant application.
Ah. Where you would want to admit to being a Kiwi.
Well, you know, it's just, it's easier to, I mean, like, I actually wouldn't know because I have failed to ever actually receive an Australian grant, but it's generally considered, your chances are considered a lot better if you don't go writing the fact that you're a Kiwi across the top of your application.
Not entirely unreasonable.
Yeah.
not at all unreasonable. So how long have you been in Australia now?
8 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been over here a long while. I mean, I've been out of New Zealand for 8 years. For been in Australia for 7, and I was in the States for 1.
Right. But, well, that would explain, because I mean, your sound is very American influenced, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Possibly getting less so, although I can't really be the judge of that. A solo, it's still very American sounding.
Yeah.
I still really enjoy writing and playing and singing country songs. Country-esque songs.
Well, how would you describe your output so far? Give me an adjective.
Well, it's the same. I still use the same one that I've been using for a while. I call it Troubadour Rock and Roll.
Yeah, okay, that works.
Particularly the newer songs that I'm performing with the band. Mm-hmm. We'll be going in and recording those, or we'll be recording a couple or a few of them. The first session for the next album is on the 21st and 22nd of October.
Oh, wow, okay.
So we'll be going in to do some of those. It's been 2.5 years since I released a proper full-length album. It was released in New Zealand more recently than that. It was released in New Zealand a year and a half ago.
That would be last year's tune, yeah?
Yeah. But over here, it's sort of been a couple of years since I've released something, and I had to clear a lot of debt incurred with the first album, and just some poor decisions on my part as to who I was working with. And...
Fair enough. So not really a musical decision so much as a practical one.
Yeah, it's been a bit tough.
Fair enough. So what sort of direction is the new material going to be taking you in then?
With the band, it's it's still quite wordy.
Yes.
I do admit that the themes tend to be quite Australian.
Okay.
Just in... Or the settings do, anyway. It's the songs take place a lot in hot places.
Right.
There are still quite a few songs about booze and things like that, because...
Well, the universal themes, really.
Universal themes, yeah. I'm actually sober at the moment, though, so I'm sitting... I've been writing today, and I'm just sitting here with a blank page, because what the fuck do I write about when I'm not writing?
a reasonable question. Well, I've noticed in the past, many of your lyrics have been very, very dark.
Yeah, expect that to continue.
Okay, fair enough. Where does that come from? Is there a dark place deep in your soul?
There's a dark place deep in all of our souls, isn't there?
Well, this is true, but yours seems to manifest itself quite extensively in your lyrics.
I think a lot of songwriters would use songs as an outlet for that. And also, I probably split my output down the middle half and half, being like half autobiographical and half observational.
Okay.
Possibly more towards the observational end. But when I find that the majority of the time when you're observing the human population, your output will be dark.
Right. Okay, that's reasonable.
It's just sort of all the evidence that you can collect, sort of try and surmise the human species
leads you to darkness and misery.
It does, yeah. Darkness and despair.
You know, that, I'm thinking of lines like "Standing in Line for the Weekend" is one song I've heard you play a couple of times, which is one of the most desperately vein opening songs I've heard in quite some time.
Desperately vain?
No, vein opening. As in, leaves one wanting to open a vein.
I thought you were implying that it was a song that I open sets with and it's vain. I was like, where is he?
Oh, heavens no. No, that would be a very troubling reading of that song, I think.
that's one that gets requested a lot over here, that I fell over.
Yes.
It's one that people ask for a lot all around Australia and in New Zealand as well, which is strange because, it's a particularly morbid one.
Yeah, so you find it resonates with people particularly, do you?
That one seems to, yeah, that seems to resonate. I do find it depends on what crowds you're playing to, but particularly at solo shows, that one gets requested a lot, and so do... Another one that gets requested an awful lot is a 6.5-minute song about the untrustworthiness of everybody.
And which song is that?
That's called "A Man Misunderstood."
Okay, and again, are we thinking it's because of the jaunty, breezy melody, or is it because of the dark, penetrating lyrics?
I think it's a lyrical thing that people request it for, which is. I mean, I can understand it. If you like a song, you request it. But a lot of the time, if you've got a 6.5-minute story song, if you've heard it once, you've heard it a million times, right?
Yes. Well, in the same way, then, if you've sung it once, you've sung it several million times. Do you find yourself getting tired of playing the same songs?
It really depends on the crowd. I can really enjoy playing songs that I've played a million times before if the crowd are into it. But I mean, I find that you switch into autopilot a lot. So if you're playing upwards of 100 shows a year, and you'll often find that with songs you've had in the set list for a while, you'll realize when you get to the end of it that you have very little memory of having just played it. You weren't present for the performing of it. It was entirely motor memory.
Right, fair enough. That does kind of make sense, yes. So tell us a little about this upcoming tour. You're doing quite an extensive trip up and down New Zealand, aren't you?
Yeah, it's going to be great fun.
Yeah, anywhere in particular you're looking forward to getting back to?
Well, there are quite a few spots on there that Dom's booked in that I've never been to.
Oh, yeah?
So there are all of those I'm really looking forward to. I'm looking forward to getting back to the Wine Cellar, obviously, because that was sort of where I started playing music.
Right, that's toward the end of the tour, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the second to last date. And then the last date is the Lee Sawmill, which is fantastic. Heaps of fun. I'm really looking forward to that one. I'm looking forward to them all. We're doing the Lit Crawl in Wellington.
Yes, I see that.
I got a message from my younger cousin telling me I think Marlon Williams is playing in Wellington that same night. So,
oh, fantastic.
I'll expect to play to an empty room and then go and catch up with Marlon afterwards for a beer.
Nonsense. I'm sure it'll go down a storm. Now, tell us a little about Dom. This is Dominic Huey, right?
Yeah.
Who's got the interesting middle name here of Tourette's. Tell us a bit about that.
I remember seeing Dom perform when I was working at the wine cellar. I would have been, 18, and he had like heaps of mates, would stroll in and sort of like recite some poetry, and he had like a sort of like a hip hop thing going at the time. He's a pretty sweet rapper. He'd do some of that. I thought he was super cool. He had like tattoos on his knuckles and stuff. Yeah, he was just a bit of a badass. And he also he wrote about Auckland, which is something that really got me when I was a kid, because everyone else that I knew would sort of, they'd emulate artists that they loved, so they'd be writing songs about America and things like that, despite the
Right.
fact that they'd never been there. But there was Dom writing these poems like Auckland fucking city, he's just like riffing about the place he actually came from and the place that I came from. And I sort of like really looked up to him for that, amongst lots of other reasons. And then we didn't actually meet properly until he was living in Melbourne.
Okay.
We were both living in Melbourne. He moved over before I did, I believe. And then we sort of at the tail end of his living here, we met and played a show or two together here. And he just, yeah, he contacted me kind of out of the blue a little while ago and asked if I wanted to do this tour.
So how are we characterizing this? Is it a co-headline tour? Is one of you the opening act? Is one of you the support act? How are we describing this?
I'd call it a co-headline, I reckon. Dominic's probably got the bigger following in New Zealand at the moment, so we could call him the headliner if we want. But I guess we're both going to be. We might be switching headline spots. I'm not sure how we're going to operate it yet. But Dom will be getting up. He actually hates being called Dom. Dominic. Here we go. He'll be getting up. We played a show in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago where he got up first, and I got up after him, and he puts on a ripper show. He gets up and just, like pretty sort of scathing social commentary, rapid fire, spoken word. And then there's some really tender, beautiful love poems in there and stuff as well. He's quite varied with what he can do.
Oh, okay.
And he puts on a great show. He really knows how to work a room. And then I got up after him because I get to hide behind a guitar and I'm just that little bit louder.
Excellent. Now, will we see the pair of you on stage together, or is it going to be separate performances?
At this point in time, it's just separate performances. We haven't really discussed doing anything together. Maybe we will, though. I'm not sure.
Well, I'll take credit then if you do
Okay, cool. Yeah.
for planting that seed.
Yeah, great. If the collab album comes out and
Yeah.
smashes all sales records, we'll chop you out something.
So it sounds like a plan to me. So it sounds like it's going to be just you on and a guitar on the stage then. No commission flats this time?
No commission flats this time, no. I mean, I tour solo for the majority of the year anyway. This year, the commission flats have played two shows.
Okay.
I tend to play solo. It's a much like logistics so much easier, but also I really enjoy the solo performance. I love being able to have that dialogue with the audience
Yeah.
and move the show in any direction that sort of seems fitting for what people want and what people are engaging with. And I do like that intimate setting, and I'm a very pro heckling performer.
Oh, okay. That's I shall bear that in mind for the Auckland show.
Dominic is not, though, I have noticed, so
Again, a good tip.
pick your timing.
And I remember the very first time I saw you play, you had your cousin Oscar Herbig on stage with you. Will he be joining you this time?
He won't be joining me this time, no. It'll just be me by myself. Oscar is sort of ramping up his solo thing over here in Australia, and he's also undertaking some serious music study at the moment. He's a very busy man. And I reckon hopefully you'll be seeing more from him soon. He may even head over and do some of New Zealand himself. And I'm sure that the next time I return to New Zealand, I'll have either the full band or at least Oscar with me.
Excellent. Well, we shall look forward to that. I shan't ask for you for any firm commitments on timeframes for that.
It'll be in 2018, I can tell you that much.
Okay, that pretty much nails it down quite nicely.
Yeah.
We shall look forward to it. Well, Skyscraper Stan Woodhouse, thank you very much for taking some time to talk to us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for giving me the buzz.
Very good. Nice to hear from Skyscraper. Is that what you call him, Skyscraper?
I call him Stan, but we're close like that.
He's very tall. He's very justly called Skyscraper Stan.
Exactly.
Steve, so he's coming up. What else have we got to look forward to in the next little while?
Well, we've been off the air or off the ether or whatever it is we've been off. I can't remember because, you know, it's podcasts and we're off, you know, things
off piste.
There you go. We've been off piste for some not inconsiderable length of time recently. Yes. And there's been quite a few announcements that are worth mentioning. Yes. While we've been gone, if you're interested in comedy, mm-hmm. Jimmy Carr, the British comedian,
yes,
who some people love, some people absolutely can't stand, personally I actually find it quite funny,
yeah,
is doing a 7-date New Zealand tour in January. He's doing all the usual suspects, Auckland all the way down to Dunedin. Again, full details on the website. It's worth taking a look, but that will be worth a visit.
Yes.
And then there's a decent selection coming up as well on top of that. Stevie Nicks,
right,
sold out her show at Spark Arena, so she's added a second show.
Yep.
That's going to be in November.
She's right. Yeah, I wonder if she's going to play "Stop Dragging My Heart Around" or something. One of the songs that was one of the songs
has
she was
to, surely
played with Tom Petty, of course, who's just recently died. And I think it'd be a lot of people. I'd be quite keen to see Stevie Nicks, I think.
Well, that's going to be Monday the 20th, Tuesday the 21st of November at Spark Arena.
Yeah.
The Monday night show is the second one that she's added, and then she's heading down to Dunedin on Friday the 24th of that week, so that she's going to be a busy girl. She's got the Pretenders opening for them.
Yeah, good show.
That'll be worth seeing. If you're into women singers of a completely different ilk, Mariah Carey has had, and I swear this is the most ill-advised name for a tour in a long time. It's called the Number Ones Tour.
Oh, really?
Yes. One wonders how many number twos she's going to be singing.
Oh, okay.
Yes, someone needs to have a word with her about that one, seriously.
I think so. I think they do. Yeah.
Nevertheless, if you're interested in listening to a load of number ones and possibly some number twos too, Thursday the 1st of February at Spark Arena, and a few Australian dates as well that we don't need to talk about.
Okay.
But that's not a good idea. Planning well in advance. Are you a fan of Pink, Simon?
No, not super. No, I mean, I'm aware of her, but...
Yeah, I didn't think you would be.
No,
now,
you know me so well.
Absolutely. Well, she's actually coming to New Zealand this time. Apparently, last time she just hung out on the West Island and didn't actually made it over to the islands that matter. But this time she's coming over and she's playing Forsyth Barr Stadium in Dunedin, September the 1st next year, and Spark Arena in Auckland. She's doing two nights, Tuesday the September the 4th, Wednesday September the 5th.
God, that's a bit of forward planning. September next year.
Just shy of a year off, isn't it? Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Now, slightly closer to today.
Yes.
We've got Macklemore. Again, are you familiar?
No, I know the name, and is that a British
act? Well, here's what I know, basically. This is going off the press release, I'm ashamed to admit. The press release refers to him as American rapper Macklemore, and that's it.
I've got completely the wrong... okay, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, but that's how I can be more informed than you. I read the press release. However, if you want to know more, get yourself to Spark Arena on February the 9th.
Okay.
Because he'll be
there.
Thank
you. Okay.
And then the following evening on February Saturday the 10th, he'll be at the TSB Arena in Wellington, but I kind of get the impression that you won't.
Probably not. But you know, I might. Hey, it could be another 21 Pilots experience for me.
Hey,
you know?
It could be, couldn't it? Yeah, it could be that the scales could fall from your. Can eyes be jaundiced? Yeah, eyes can be jaundiced, can't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
We can flog that analogy. Now, here's a name I know you'll know, Brian Adams.
Yes, I know the name. Yes, Canadian chappie.
Canadian chappie, yes. the very fellow. We know more about him than that, though, surely.
Yeah, no, I know. I remember his big hits back in the day and Summer of 69 and all that sort of stuff.
Run to You, Cuts Like a Knife.
Yes, yeah. I mean, he was a... I always thought, particularly with the way he sang, his voice, that he... I don't know whether it was... he really did have a voice like that, or he was affecting a sort of gravelly type voice, but it always felt to me he was trying to channel Springsteen. But that might be just my own personal bias. But
no, it was definitely gargling on gravel a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're right, the music's not a million miles removed, is it?
No.
Well, if the presence of Bryan Adams doesn't do it for you, this might sweeten the deal. His support acts are going to be Dave Dobbin.
Oh, yeah.
And the Jordan Luck Band.
Oh, okay. Oh, that would... Okay, that's a good selection.
That's caught your attention, hasn't it?
Yeah. Go see those guys.
Exactly. And he's also playing a decently eclectic selection of venues.
Okay.
Matakana.
All right. Really?
New Plymouth.
Right.
Mount Maunganui. And Hawke's Bay.
Where's he going to play at Matakana, I wonder?
The Matakana Country Park, of course. Where else would he play?
Where else? Well, that's within cooey of us here. So in
Auckland. It is. Now, that's on January the 2nd.
Ah. Okay.
And then the 4th, 5th and 6th for the other dates as well. And again, all this information's on the website, cravepodcast.com. Mm. But yeah, that's actually an extremely interesting little lineup, that one.
It is. I'm going to mention one thing coming up because it's just a couple of weeks away, Steve.
Yeah.
And you're going to go, oh, no, you're not mentioning that again. But it is yet another Marvel movie, Thor Ragnarok. But there is a particular Kiwi interest here.
Because yes, of
it
is course directed, there is, isn't there?
Directed by Taika Waititi, the New Zealand director. He's known for his a very effervescent sense of humour and a quirky and clever sense of humour. And from the little bits I'm picking up from the mainstream media, it sounds like he's infused this Marvel film with that.
Oh, God, they need it so badly.
Yeah, so I'm kind of interested to see how a bit of Kiwi goes down in the Marvel universe. I'd be quite interested to see that. I think it's only a couple of weeks away.
Yes, it is. It's not far off. We shall definitely have to cover that one when the time comes.
Yes. Okay. Lovely. I think that's about us, isn't it? This week, I think it is.
By God, I hope so by now. Yeah, we've certainly covered a lot of material there.
You can. So we would, apart from getting out and about and looking at things, we'd love to hear from you as well. You can send us an email at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
So I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Outstanding.